Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's May 19, 2017 program, Dams, Rivers, and Reservoirs, How Safe. This is a 32nd program in a current programming year, 2016-2017 year. My name is Juan Carlos Valle, City Club Board President. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy. Become a member today if you haven't by going to www.cityclubofeugene.org. Support, speaking of, to the City Club is provided by our members and also from sponsors, including the Oregon Country Fair. The Oregon Country Fair creates experiences that nourish the spirits, explore living artfully and authentically on earth, and transform culture in magical, joyous, and healthy ways. And now on to the coordinator of today's program, Mr. Randy Prince, whom will introduce the topic and introduce our speakers. Randy Prince, welcome.
Thanks, Juan Carlos. Today's program is about a complicated cost-benefit problem. It has no simple answer, even if we had plenty of money for solutions. We're going to talk about the status of dams that were built to control the flooding that plagued non-native settlement ever since it began here early in the 19th century. The subject is the Willamette Valley Project of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. 13 dams in all, many of them in Lane County. They brought us safety. No more water on Willamette Street. No more of the inevitable inundations in Glenwood or the lowland on the north side of the river here. They made unsafe land safe. Homes and commercial development proceeded. Our community took on the look and shape we see today. We depend on these dams. The dam building began in the 1940s. Fern Ridge Dam was first one finished in 1941. The last of the big dams are finished in the late 1960s. About a dozen years ago, in 2005, Fern Ridge Lake was drained and the dam reconstructed. The rest of the embankment structures still stand as built over 50 years ago, with various repairs and upgrades added over the years. But during that last half century, our scientific knowledge of the land continued to grow. We learned the Pacific Northwest was in fact not exempted from the effects of big subduction zone earthquakes emanating from deep in the earth. In fact, that they happened every few centuries here, with the last occurrence in 1700. We also gathered more evidence about fault lines higher up in the earth's crust, about soil underneath dams, and about unstable hillsides and past landslides near big reservoirs. And more recently, we've noticed changes in climate and that rainfall might not be as predictable as in the past. None of this was in the specifications that the 20th century engineers used in designing our buildings, bridges, and yes, these dams. Is the margin of safety of the last century's designs enough to meet the greater threat of that we know in this, the 21st century? The big cataclysmic events that we understand to be real, they're not fanciful thinking. There's a probability of a major event, 8.0 quake on the Cascadia subduction zone, up in the 30-40%. The biggest event, maybe 10 or 15%, we're talking about in the next 50 years. That's why disaster preparedness people say it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. But about the dams, those are labeled as an extremely low probability of failure. Now, those of us who personally like to be prepared for events, we do engage in fanciful thinking. 7 minutes of intense shaking in the entire Northwest, reservoirs, waves developing, station, landslides, water going over the top of dams, the destructive process begins, water comes rushing out, coming down the valley 2, 4, 6, 8 hours before it hits us, carrying houses, cars, critters. Bigfoot, he's jumped on a log and he's going to ride it out to safety. The rest of us, we're going to be shark food somewhere in the Pacific off of Astoria. Well, maybe not. But how do we know? How precisely do we need to know? And what if we determine something's not safe from the seismic standpoint? How do we do what's needed without exposing ourselves to the original risk, the uncontrolled river that once regularly flooded our community and could once again flood the places we live and the places we never would have lived before the water was regulated? Our two speakers will help us get a handle on these questions. We have today Eric Peterson, and he is the Operations Project Manager of the Willamette Valley Project for the Portland District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He will speak second. First, we have Professor Ray Weldon. He's a professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Oregon. He used to be known as the Geology Department. He's a risk consultant for dam operators in California. Among many positions he's held, he is a member of the National Hazard Mapping Team. Ray will start us off.
Thank you, Randy, and thank you all for attending. I'm honored to have the opportunity to talk to the City Club and also to talk more broadly to the KLCC audience. I want to start with a bang here, so to speak, and so I want to say that there's little doubt amongst people like myself who study seismic hazards that the Cascadia subduction zone can produce an earthquake large enough, or that there's an unknown crustal fault in the Cascades that can produce an earthquake close enough to damage one of our dams upstream. That said, we live with many far, far more likely risks. And there are substantial benefits, as Randy pointed out, to having the dams. So we need to understand how likely is it that an earthquake will damage one or more dams, and what it would cost to significantly change those odds. Forecasts of strong ground motion at a site due to earthquakes are usually calculated probabilistically. This is what I and my students and colleagues at the USGS do to make the National Seismic Hazard Earthquake Source Model, from which we generate maps of hazard and risk that are used to set building codes and to guide insurance rates, risk reduction, and emergency preparedness efforts. You can find these products by searching for USGS Earthquake Hazards Program, and then click on Hazards, and then click on Maps and Site-Specific Data. The products are probabilistic for two reasons. First, we really don't care if a magnitude 9-plus earthquake at the coast or a 5.9 right under our feet brings the roof down on us. What we want to know is the chance of the roof coming down from all possible sources in a given period of time, usually the design lifetime of the structure. Second, we have extremely large uncertainties in the information that goes into the ground motion models, which in a probabilistic model we can include within our forecasts. For example, the geologic evidence for Cascadia earthquakes includes a range of sizes of earthquakes, time intervals between events, and many other unknown factors or poorly known factors. The length, location, rupture direction, depth of rupture, and most especially how shaking decreases with distance, which is called attenuation, affect how strongly, how long, and at what frequencies the ground will shake at a given site. We estimate and include ranges of values for all of these factors to determine how likely it is to exceed some threshold of shaking at a given frequency, and if it matters, duration in a given period of time at sites we care about, such as dams. Okay. I have two reasons for boring you with my lecture and how to make a seismic hazard model. The first reason is that the principal use of these models is to inform building codes. So we usually present the results as a level of shaking that will exceed 2%, that will be exceeded 2% of the time in a 50-year interval. This seems reasonable, as we don't want to spend the money to completely earthquake-proof all of our structures, but we want the chance of failure that results in a loss of life to be pretty small. Unfortunately, this challenging level of shaking has been portrayed to the public as likely to happen, or is even called overdue in some media reports. To get to the 2% and 50-year probability level, which is equivalent to saying there's a 98% chance that the shaking will be less in the next 50 years, you need the largest possible subduction zone earthquake, a 9.2 plus, that spans the entire subduction zone, more than 1,000 kilometers, and a very low attenuation or rate of decrease in shaking with distance. However, the most likely subduction zone earthquake in the next 50 years is actually a mid-magnitude 8 off the southwest Oregon coast that will cause no damage in the region of our dams. Now, I don't want you to overreact to that statement any more than I want you to overreact to my first statement, because they're both important. There's a huge difference between what is likely to happen in a short period of time and what can happen. Unlikely events happen. People win the lottery. And for critical structures like dams, whose failure have catastrophic consequences, we want a much smaller probability than just 2% in 50 years. The second reason for my lecture is that there is a lot we can do to reduce the uncertainties in our estimates and improve our forecasts. And in particular, because low probability events come from the tails of our uncertainty distributions, reducing the uncertainties will almost certainly also diminish our estimates of the hazard. So I'd like to end my presentation here by shamelessly promoting some of the work that my U of O colleagues are doing to help better characterize this hazard and to reduce the uncertainties. First of all, I'd like to mention Doug Toomey, who's sitting right here. Put your hand up, Doug. Who runs the Oregon part of the USGS's Pacific Northwest Seismic Network. And he's working to add an early warning component that can give us tens of seconds to actually minutes of warning after a major earthquake occurs that could be used to reduce the consequences of the shaking by doing something before the shaking reaches a site. Second, I'd like to mention Amanda Thomas, who's working on empirically measuring attenuation or how shaking decreases with distance and by site conditions to reduce the very large uncertainties in our estimates of strong ground motion. It turns out that almost half of the uncertainty in our hazard models comes just from the attenuation relationships. Third, Josh Roaring is mapping and dating recent landslides to determine if they are earthquake triggered. To be frank, I'm as worried about landslides as I am about ground motion from Cascadia. Either a Cascadia earthquake or an unknown crustal fault near a dam could trigger a large landslide into one of our reservoirs, which could lead to overtopping and subsequent erosion, as we came close to seeing by the extreme flooding at the Oroville Dam in California. Better mapping and dating of the faults and landslides in the Cascades with modern tools that allow us to see through the trees like LIDAR would greatly address this possibility. Anyway, I thank you for your attention, and I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, City Club of Eugene, for inviting me here to speak today. Ray, I appreciate your background, your discussion on risk and relative risk and what we might do to think differently and act differently about what we have in front of us. I want to say, following the other speakers, I am not a lawyer, but I am married to a lawyer. She's in the audience. Her name is Erin Fennerty, and she is my better half. As introduced, I'm the operations project manager for the Willamette Valley projects, and I'm no expert in dam safety or geology or seismic risk. I've worked in the field for 30 years, and I work with lots of experts, and I think about risk all the time, and so I have some perspective to offer, and if there's a question that comes up today that I cannot respond to, I'm more than happy to take it back with me and get you a specific answer. So I'll make that commitment to you now. Prior to lunch, I bumped into Linda Cook. Linda's the emergency manager for Lane County. And Linda said, "Hey, are you going to scare us all?" And I said, "Yes, Linda, start running now." And she knows me better than that, and she didn't start running. So she's still here, I believe. So I intend to introduce this system and its benefits, talk a little bit about the way we view and manage risks. Time is limited. Ordinarily, I speak rather extemporaneously. I'm going to stick to my notes because I want to respect time. You've heard lots about the Willamette system already. You know that it's comprised of 13 dams. 9 of these dams are in Lane County. 8 of these dams are upstream of Eugene and Springfield. And they all work together to contribute to an overall function and value that benefits the quality of our lives and the way that we have developed the valley and the way that we live. The cities of Oak Ridge, Cottage Grove, Springfield, Eugene, Albany, Salem, and Portland, as well as Monroe on the Coast Fork, all benefit from this system that prevents flooding, provides a number of other benefits as well. When I first moved to Eugene in 2004, I met an older gentleman named Bob Kintai. He's a former state senator. And Bob told me that where I bought my home in the Ferry Street Bridge area formerly had been the confluence of the Willamette and the McKenzie about every other year. And I said, "Well, maybe I bought in the wrong place." I didn't. Never was flooded out while I lived there. And now I lived in the Southwest. Now I live in the Southwest Hills, and certainly am above any flood risk, but certainly not oblivious to any seismic risk. To date, the Willamette system has prevented over $25 billion in damages. But from flooding by temporarily storing water during winter storms and releasing water when unregulated runoff subsides. It stores 1.6 million acre feet of water, and in the summer months, this water supports reservoir recreation, downstream water quality, water supply, habitat benefits, and water supply for irrigation. The most easily quantified benefits for the system yield about $1.2 billion annually in value to the region. Obviously, without the flood risk management benefits, lives and property would be much more frequently impacted by flooding. The valley wouldn't have developed or been productive in the way that we experience it now, and we manage a quarter of the surface area above the confluence of the Willamette with the Columbia. As you move upstream, it's almost 40% of the runoff above Salem, about 45% above Albany. And right here in Eugene Springfield, it's two-thirds of the surface area runoff. It's controlled or managed through our facilities, the Willamette system. So we are highly influenced by this system of dams. The valley produces roughly enough energy through hydroelectric generation to power all the households in Eugene and Springfield. It plays an important role for grid stability on the California intertie, and individual plants are frequently depended upon to provide energy to communities like Oak Ridge and Sweet Home when the transmission lines from BPA go down. Those communities are islanded, and the value of the power that we produce is roughly $25 million a year. Value of recreation on the reservoirs is significant, contributing nearly $100 million of national economic development when you consider multipliers to the region. And water quality is entirely dependent upon the augmentation that we do during the summer months that benefits species as well as allows point source discharges in Springfield, Albany, Salem, and Portland so that we can use water and have it not impact rivers. As the Willamette Valley develops, anticipate the need for and the interest in municipal and industrial water supply to increase exponentially over time. So this system of dams was not developed without some major trade-offs and major impacts. Some of the big trade-offs for people included relocation of families, relocation of people, inundation of prehistoric and historic sites, disruption of natural river flows, barriers to native fish, and impacts to the overall function and integrity of the Willamette and its tributaries. Well, while buying down the risk, it really changed the form of risk to people. And to answer the question, how safe, requires some dialogue. I hope that by the end of this conversation today, will have addressed that somewhat and facilitated better understanding. Prior to development of the system, people experienced flooding on a pretty constant basis in the wintertime. You know, bounded on the east by the Cascades and the west by the Coast Range, there are places in the Willamette Valley that get up to 100 inches of precipitation a year. That's a lot of rain. By impounding up to 1.6 million acre feet of water, we no longer face frequent flooding. Even substantial precipitation events, storm events, are well mitigated. We still face the impacts of stochastic events, significant flooding beyond the capacity of our facilities to manage. And although probabilities are very low, we also face the risk of failure of our structures and the release of large quantities of stored water. It's important to know how we characterize risk. Risk is really a function of the hazard, of performance, of exposure, of vulnerability, and of consequences. The hazard is what can go wrong. Performance is how well will the system react. Exposure, who and what are in harm's way. Vulnerability, how susceptible to harm are those things. And consequence is the extent of the harm. We think of risk as a continuum. On one side, we have unacceptable risk, things that, in my mind, that relate to the topic that were unacceptable was Fern Ridge in 2005. We had a failing foundation drain, actively failing dam at that point in time, and we ended up, in about 9 months' time, tearing down two-thirds of the downstream slope of that dam, removing it, replacing the foundation drain, and rebuilding that structure. So we missed one recreation season, but we missed really zero flood seasons as a consequence of our dam safety program. Tolerable risk is in the middle, the tolerable, acceptable range. Really, tolerable is a better word than acceptable, because if we could, we would want to eliminate all risk, but that's not possible. And things that I think of as tolerable risk, getting on a domestic flight in the United States, there are all kinds of ways that flying in an airplane is made safe and managed to that end. And generally speaking, flying in an airplane domestically is very safe. Then there are broadly acceptable risks on the other end of the spectrum. I think maybe going out to eat dinner in Eugene, generally pretty safe and a broadly acceptable risk. Our approach to managing risks of this system are to manage risks to a point as low as reasonably practicable. And really this means to dealing with those risks and managing them to the point of diminishing returns. We can rank relative risk better than we can quantify absolute risk, but our dam safety program is increasingly working to quantify risk. Our overall strategy is about challenging assumptions with fresh perspective and updated science, and working to understand, prioritize liabilities, and to manage risk within that tolerable range. Our understanding of risk has not been static. We know more about the hazards, about the performance of our structures and system, and about the consequences of failure much more comprehensively than we have in the past. Our understanding has been evolutionary, and our approach to thinking about risk and managing it has changed a lot over time, particularly since Hurricanes Katrina and Rita back 10 or 15 years ago. Our program has always involved real-time monitoring. We have instrumentation on our facilities, we have eyes on the ground, and we're looking at things constantly. We have annual inspections where we bring locally and regionally experts down to walk our facilities, to look at aggregated data, and to look at trends, and to make judgments about those. We support periodic inspections using a more regional cadre of experts every 5 years, and we climb all the structures. We look at every detail of the project, as well as looking at data and challenging assumptions about trends. And every 10 years, we combine periodic inspections with periodic assessments, where we bring in a national cadre of experts, fresh eyes, and we perform probable failure mode analyses, where we look at what could happen, and we analyze what we know against what we think could happen as a vulnerability, challenging assumptions about the hazards, performance, and consequences again, and ranking facilities on a dam safety action classification scale. That scale is important. The Corps of Engineers has, you know, over 500 major dams in their portfolio nationwide. In the last decade, again, we really refined our corporate approach to ranking risk and prioritizing funding to buy down the greatest portfolio risk first. We first undertook screening portfolio risk assessments and subsequently developed periodic assessments with probable failure mode analyses of all of our structures nationally so that we could make that quantification and that prioritization and buy down the highest risk first. Facilities that have a one ranking are high-risk dams needing immediate action to mitigate and diminish that risk. You may have heard of a couple of these facilities. One is Isabella in California. It had both hydrologic and seismic vulnerabilities, and they're fixing both of those. We've been working on those for about 9 years and buying down that risk. Another is Wolf Creek Dam on Lake Cumberland in Kentucky. And Wolf Creek Dam had a karst topography foundation, so limestone foundation that was being eroded away, and we're putting grout below that facility to buy down that risk. On the other end of the spectrum, a dam safety action classification 5 dam is the Richard B. Russell project on the Savannah River in South Carolina and Georgia, and we call that a unicorn. There aren't too many dams that are DSAC rated 5 where so many things about the facility and the risk are known, and there's no heavy demand to mitigate by additional studies. In the Willamette Valley, based on the risk assessments that we've done, none of the valley's dams were judged 1s. We have 4 DSAC or 3 DSAC 4 dams, Dorena, Dexter, and Big Cliff, 3 DSAC 3 dams, Fern Ridge, Detroit, and Cottage Grove, and 7 DSAC 2 dams, Blue River, Cougar, Fall Creek, Foster, Green Peter, Hills Creek, and Lookout. The risk drivers are specific questions we have about either hazards or facility performance. They're being addressed through research in the form of issue evaluation studies at these dams that are DSAC rated 2. Risk drivers for valley facilities include embankment instability for seismic hazards, embankment and facility overtopping due to hydrologic hazards, internal erosion performance issues due to both seismic and hydrologic hazards, foundation liquefaction and monolith instability related to seismic hazards, penstock, spillway pier, and spillway gate vulnerability to seismic hazards, and spillway gate risk due to trunnion bearing friction. Over time, we've bought down some of these risks, particularly the trunnion friction risk on most of our 42 spillway gates around the valley. But these other issues, many of them you heard seismic, and we do the probable seismic hazard analysis, where we're using some of the same models that Ray has talked about to better understand the implications to our facility, the performance based on what the hazard could be, and then based on that understanding, we have the ability to prioritize nationally and buy down that risk. If, in most cases, these DSAC 2, Dam Safety Action Classification System rated 2 dams, we hope that through better understanding, we're able to simply clarify our perspective on the risk and move that down to a 3 or a 4 or maybe even a 5. In the event that we go the other direction or we have some known mitigation measure that we need to address, then we get, if a dam goes to a DSAC rated 1, then we get immediate funding from our headquarters office and immediate national resources being applied to the problem. We also may implement interim risk reduction measures, for example, holding a reservoir low until we get the problem solved so that we don't exacerbate or add to risk. In the case that we still have additional risk that we need to mitigate for after an issue evaluation study, we apply a dam safety modification study. It looks at feasibility of alternatives and what's the best way to buy down that risk. Since 2016, we've had these issue evaluation studies underway at Cougar, Green Peter, Foster, Hills Creek, Lookout Point, and then we also have regional hydrologic and seismic studies underway. And we're spending literally millions of dollars to better understand and characterize the risk so we can rank it, so we can buy down what needs to be bought down. And these will clarify and quantify our risk and help to move the ratings from either lower to higher or clarify and get attention to those that may end up with a lower rating. So You know, a lot of the focus of the conversation today has been about seismic hazards, with particular reference to the Cascadian subduction earthquake. And I've talked to lots of our dam safety officials. I've talked to folks at Dogami. I've looked at some of the data myself. And what I understand is that there's potential to have minor impacts to our facilities from a subduction type earthquake at an order of magnitude 9, 80 or 90 miles off the coast. But for myself, I'm far more concerned about my family and fuel and food and transmission and distribution of electricity and roads and bridges and what I might do if communication is cut off and how I might be able to manage my staff of 150 or 160 people across the valley. So we've implemented or put in place contingency plans that allow us to kind of fall back, allow other parts of our organization to move in and take over facilities management, because we think we'll still be managing facilities. They're not going to go away, and allow us to take care of our families. But that's the concern that I have. Other earthquakes at intervals of 2,500 to perhaps 10,000 years could result in ground motions that could significantly impact even very robust facilities. And I think that's some of the stuff you're talking about, Ray. Potential impacts from that type of event, crustal events that maybe we don't know about yet, include potential damage to spillway gates, regulating outlets, and powerhouses that may impact our ability to move water effectively and efficiently and with the level of expertise that we do now, but may not necessarily lead to a catastrophic dam failure. The likelihood and consequences of partial or complete dam failure as a result of a seismic event really depends on the size and location of the earthquake, the reservoir level, the dam's current operational status, and many other factors that are all hard to predict. So we can't anticipate all possible impacts from seismic events, but we know that dams were built to the standards of their day, using the best available information to withstand even significant earthquakes or other seismic events specific to their locations. We know that our own understanding of regional seismic hazards continues to evolve. And again, really, we're aware of subduction zone faults now, and we weren't 30 years ago. But despite the uncertainties we have about hazards and facility performance, the historical performance of dams in seismic events has been really, really good. Only one concrete dam in modern history has ever failed as a result of a seismic event. In that case, the fault ran directly beneath the structure. Generally, concrete dams have performed very well, sustaining only minor damage. The data on the performance of embankment dams is more limited, but the number that has failed as a consequence of a seismic event is still relatively small. Only about 1.5% of historical failures of embankment dams have been attributed to earthquakes. The only known complete dam failure as a result of seismic shaking, or the only known failures as a result of seismic shaking, were tailings or hydraulic fill dams, or other relatively small earth fill embankments of older and possibly inadequate design and construction. One recent example of a big earthquake, 2011 9.0 earthquake in Japan, was basically the Western Pacific analog of a Cascadia event. One small irrigation dam completely failed. 252 dams in proximity inspected the next day revealed that 6 embankment dams had shallow cracks on their crest, but all damaged dams were functioning with no problems. That was a big event. Another recent example, the February 27, 2010 earthquake in Chile, was basically the South American analog of a Cascadia event. No embankment dams failed, and only a few suffered more than minor damage. So while we're also running to ground, we're running to ground the seismic issues, we're also running to ground the hydrologic issues, the water issues. The relative known risks are small, with probable maximum floods ranging in frequency, interval frequency from 1 to 10,000 to 1 to 100,000, and that performance of some embankments and facilities, even when overtopped, may be acceptable. Finally, I just want to reemphasize the point about being prepared. We take risks all the time. When I ate bacon and eggs for breakfast this morning, I took a risk. When I drove to work this morning, I took a risk. When I walked here at lunch from my office, I took a risk. When I go for a run tomorrow morning, I'll take another risk. I understand these risks and manage them on a constant basis. Cascadia, if and when it happens during our lifetimes, understanding where those risks really are for us and having a personal plan to mitigate them is a smart thing to do. And it's pretty easily accomplished. Of all the things that concern me, having that personal contingency plan, being able to take care of my family, is probably my biggest concern. I'm confident that our dams will not face major damages. I'm more worried about food and fuel for my family. We all depend on the safe operation of the Willamette Valley dams. Our lives are accustomed to well-managed flood risks. These dams represent hazards to significant populations, however, because of the water they store behind them. We have a good understanding of risks, but are driving hard to refine that understanding on a constant basis. And we've got a systematic and comprehensive way of doing that. We take our responsibility very seriously and will not be complacent. Our dam safety program is evolving with increasing ability to quantify risk through knowing hazards, understanding facility performance, and knowing consequences with increasing granularity. We are constantly challenging our foundational assumptions and driving improvement. Our approach for addressing portfolio risk, risk-informed decision-making, and portfolio-based prioritization is both responsible and responsive to needs, and will continue to allow the Willamette Valley system to relatively safely provide management of water resources far into the future. Our dams, as we know now, are tolerably safe. Our understanding of that risk is getting progressively better. Thank you.
Okay, so let us break for just a couple of minutes to come up with some questions. Remember that only City Club members get to come to the microphone to ask those questions. However, if you're visiting today, you can also help put together that question. So we'll come back in a couple of minutes. Welcome back to the May 19, 2017 program, Dams, Rivers, and Reservoir, How Safe? Before we start with the member questions, allow me to announce our four elected, newly elected City Club Board of Directors positions. And that is, welcome once again, Josh Burstein, Lou Powell, and new members, Stephanie Harger and Mr. Evan Reese. Thank you so much for willing to stand and for your service. Also, it is my pleasure to introduce and announce our next president-elect, Joel Coring. Thank you, Joel Coring, for your willingness to stand for election. He is going to take over May 2018 after Sandra finishes her service to City Club. For the minutes, Mr. Secretary, we finished the annual meeting at 12:25, in which we elected board members and president-elect that closed our meeting. And now on to our club members' questions, 30 seconds or less. We only have a few minutes. Go right ahead.
Hi, Linda Jensen, City Club member. I was wondering about the potential for a domino effect. It should one of the uppermost dams fail, whether or not, you know, there's a possibility of taking out all the dams downstream of it, and whether or not in the risk assessment that you said where none of them was a two, if that was something that you considered in that scenario and gave it a two, even if one of the uppermost ones had failed.
Great question. Question of cumulative impacts of multiple failures consecutively. For example, Hills Creek, Lookout Point, Dexter, downstream on the Middle Fork. And yes, that's part of the reason for the regional hydrologic study. And we have factored that potential scenario into our dam failure inundation mapping, looking at consequences, looking at population at risk. And really, because of the population at risk in the Willamette Valley, that's what elevates our need to better understand hazards as well as performance of the facilities because of those consequences. So great question, and yes, we are factoring that into our analysis.
Next question.
Hi, Mariah Learn. A question from the audience. Are the inundation maps for the dams available to the public? If not, why not? And is it true that if the dam above Oak Ridge broke, this room would be underwater?
So the first part of the question is about inundation maps, dam failure inundation maps, and we have shared dam failure inundation maps with the public in a number of forums, and we will share specific data with individuals. Dam failure inundation maps look at, they compare a couple of different scenarios, and they look at travel time of water and elevation of water if dams failed. Dams can fail in a variety of ways, slowly, quickly. We look at some extreme events. What we don't want to do is we don't want to put all of the data and information comprehensively into the hands of one or more individuals who may try to use that information to cause harm. But we absolutely have, through our county emergency managers, made those data available to folks, and we've also done so in public meetings in recent years.
Next question.
Paul Thompson, a City Club member. This is a question for Ray. In your presentation, you indicated that 50% of the uncertainty in the model is attributable to the attenuation factor. You also alluded to the fact that there was work going on to improve our knowledge of the attenuation. My question is, when will that work be done? What do you expect is going to be the improvement? And when will it be incorporated into the model?
Thank you. So a couple of quick answers to this. The first part of this is that attenuation is only taken into account in a very empirical way, in which, based on past earthquakes, people have measured shaking at various distances, and then they make a curve and effectively look at the uncertainties in that curve. And because attenuation varies dramatically from area to area, these compilations that are based on global data sets or different regions where the shaking changes in different ways are not very useful. And so, well, that's probably not fair to say, are not as useful as they could be if you used a unique attenuation relationship for the particular region. So the National Seismic Hazard Map has been working on this. So we have attenuation relationships that vary regionally now. And in fact, in June, I'm going to a meeting where we're working on attenuation relationships that take into account major basins. So, for example, the LA Basin or the Seattle Basin or some of the large basins in the Midwest as well. So we're to the point where we're starting, we have some regionalization of these, and also we're about to implement large basins, and we would like to do this on a more and more granular scale so that it could be useful for us here. I mentioned Amanda Thomas. She's actually working on a project currently in this region, and what she does is sets out literally hundreds of seismometers, literally in people's backyards. And so she was recently funded, and she's going to do a project where she's going to be soliciting people to actually put seismometers in their yards so they can actually collect data from small earthquakes, ambient noise sources, things like that. And so we're about to dramatically enlarge our current data set. But again, the other point I want to make, we know a lot about shaking proximal to earthquakes, but as you go farther and farther away, we know a lot less about the shaking, and for all kinds of reasons. And so this is partly why there's such a large uncertainty in terms of what the shaking will be in the region of the dams for Cascadia, for example, because we're so far away that those relationships that tell us how shaking will decrease make a big difference. It makes a big difference for us here in Eugene as well, because we're quite far away from the source. And depending upon, really how shaking decreases will make a big difference for what we're seeing here. Let's see, there was something else. Was there another part of the question there that I haven't answered already?
When will the work be done?
Yes, that was when will the work begun? So the portion that we're working on the national level will be in the next iteration of the National Seismic Hazard Map and Source Model. That's on a six-year cycle, and we just completed the last cycle in 2014. So that'll be like 2020 on a national basis. The work that Amanda and others are doing locally will be on sort of the next couple of years.
Next question.
All right. James Baldock, City Club member. There was a dam in California in February of this year. I think it was called the Oroville Dam. I was wondering, prior to the February event, what ranking was that? Was that like a 1, a 2, a 3, or 4, or 5?
Really good question. I would call it a 0 because it's not in our system. It's not a Corps of Engineers dam. It's a California Water Resources Department dam. And really, its operating parameters are very, very different. The context and situation there is different. The vulnerabilities, really in advance of what was observed this spring, were very different. And I do a presentation called Not Oroville. I'd be more than happy to talk about that in great detail, but I need about 30 minutes. Altogether, a different animal.
All right, next question.
I'm Jack Dresser. I have a question from the audience. Has it not been possible to remove a number of dams throughout Oregon because they were no longer needed or never needed, and to allow for better fish habitat and passage upriver, and due to the cost of updating being too expensive?
That's a really good question, slightly political. I'll say yes. A number of dams have been removed. Those are primarily power production dams, and the purpose and intent of those dams is different. Probably the more famous dams that I'm aware of are up in the state of Washington. Elwha Dam, big dam removed. Power production dam did not prevent or manage flood risk to people. And so people have asked me before, hey, what do you think about, you know, removal of the dams in the valley? And I say, well, that's really not my job or my purview. That's a political question. If we did remove the dams in the valley, our lifestyle would change, and so many things for us would change. The mission that we have here is essential for continuity of life as we know it in the valley.
Next question.
Thank you. Sandra Bishop, City Club member. This is not supposed to be a political question. Does the city and county have a plan to expedite post-earthquake building permits for repairing damaged structures? What's the recovery plan? Do you have any idea of local entities if they're going to be dealing with that?
Okay. I think it's for you.
This is Eric Peterson. I really have no jurisdiction there and no ability to answer that question. I know that locally and regionally, emergency managers and city governments work to build resiliency. I know that that we have people thinking about those kind of issues, but I can't speak with authority on their behalf.
John DeLoe, City Club member, and I had a couple of quick questions. What would be the worst case scenario, either one of you, and how much potential is there for liquefaction on some of these earth dams?
Ray, is that for you?
Well, I'll answer the first part of the question there. And I think to some extent the worst case scenarios are on the order of these sort of worst case floods that Eric mentioned a bit. In very round numbers, you would start to see minor damage on dams at a shaking that we forecast to occur about every 3,000 years. And you would start to see something that we would expect to cause significant damage to perhaps some sort of failure on the order of 10,000 years, which are similar numbers to what Eric said. Again, those scenarios involve the largest possible Cascadia event, but they also involve crestal faults, which we haven't talked much about. And so just to expand on that a little bit, we keep finding more crestal faults in the Cascades. I was on a field trip a few weeks ago where the Delgami recently flew some LIDAR and discovered some new faults that are near Collier Glacier area. And we also have a project where we're dating landslides, and we're learning that there are landslides in the Cascades that are quite young. Bonneville landslide, for example, is one. And so the current model has a magnitude up to 7.9 on a crustal fault in the Cascades, which to me sounds pretty big. Fortunately, in the model, it's quite rare. It occurs on average sort of on the order of 10,000 years or so return period, perhaps a little longer than that. And so, as I mentioned sort of briefly, I think the worst case scenario from my perspective is that we would have a large seven or something like that in the Cascades. It's proximal enough that would cause some of these very large landslides that we see in the landscape into one of the reservoirs. So that would be kind of the worst case scenario, and the forecast numbers are that something like that could happen on the order of once every 10,000 years.
What about all the heavy rain we get around here? Would that have any effect?
Well, I'll let Eric Adds answer the rain part.
You know, all the heavy rain we get, that's why we're here, and really our facilities were constructed at the time that they were designed and constructed for somewhere in a 10,000 year interval to 100,000 year interval event. That's not, and really that means that our facilities will survive without failing. It doesn't mean that we wouldn't have to pass inflows at some point and inundate the valley down below. We manage flood risk. We don't control flooding.
Next question.
Karen Seidel, City Club member. You've both talked a lot about seismic events. What's the risk of a terrorist blowing up the dam at Cougar Reservoir?
That is a really good question and an evolving threat, and we manage that kind of risk in partnership with lots of other entities, and I can tell you, I think the likelihood of such an event would be low. I think there are other more visible targets around the country, as well as targets that would be easier to compromise. And I can't really talk to those, but they're not in our system.
Okay, last question.
Randy Prince, City Club member. I was pleased to hear that you have funding available for Army Corps engineer dams that are reaching a certain threshold. That's the first I'd heard. And is this kind of unique to the Army Corps? I remember about the time Fern Ridge Dam was determined that it needed reconstruction, that it needed to be drained. It was another dam in California, I think it's called the Success Dam, and they said this, we found new scientific knowledge, the danger is too high, and I said, let's take the water down. And then I kind of looked at later, and it was like, well, we can't get the money, or, you know, maybe we should decide it's not as dangerous. I mean, it's still a mystery to me, and I'm not sure where they're at, but it was not a straightforward process. And this is what I've always wondered about, is could the uncertainty of a major repair or reconstruction, and how many billions of dollars would it take if several of these dams from the 50s were found to be too old or just not strong enough? So are you saying the Army Corps really stands out, and the fact that the Army Corps has that system now in place? This is pretty recent. Could you elaborate a little bit more on this?
Absolutely, Randy. That's a great question. So in the past, Fern Ridge Dam, for example, in 2005, when we had problems, we had to pull money from the region and reprioritize activities within the region. And for about $25 million, we rebuilt that dam in a short period of time. When you start doing that on a massive scale, you're reacting all the time, and there are unintended consequences for that. We changed our program, and our program really is designed to quantify the risk, be able to prioritize nationally where those biggest risks are, and buy down as much risk as we can as fast as we can. And that means that at our headquarters level, there's a holdback of all of the appropriations that we get. Project by project appropriations, there's money held off the top. It's those funds that go to prioritize, to fund the highest priorities that we have and buy down that risk. That's where Wolf Creek is getting funding. That's where exactly where our issue evaluation studies are being funded from. That's how we have literally millions of dollars being invested right now into better understanding the nature of the hazard and the performance of our facilities in the environment that we're in. We're able to do that by attacking national priorities.
And Ray, any closing statements? Go ahead.
I guess what I'd like to say is that a lot of the things that I was talking about and a lot of our hazards are driven by uncertainty. And so in sort of a similar answer to the recent question here is obviously to diminish those uncertainties requires that we have additional information, which requires that we have additional resources. And so I guess my concluding statement would be that we think a little bit about the resources. As I mentioned, another aspect is earthquake early warning. Doug here in the audience is pushing this hard. We don't have the resources yet to have an operational system, but we can sort of see what the usefulness of it would be. Another point would be, as I mentioned briefly a second ago, that we really don't know the distribution of active faults or the distribution of and ages of landslides in the Cascades that obviously are going to come into the valleys that have reservoirs in them. And some resources, fairly limited resources, would allow us to diminish the uncertainty a lot. So I guess my concluding statement is that there really is a lot we can do. The hazard is, you know, the odds of something really bad happening are in sort of the 1 in 1,000 chance a year to the 1 in 10,000 chance per year. It's not huge, okay? But I think we could really do quite a lot with a fairly minimal amount of investment to actually figure out those uncertainties, just as I could imagine you could do a lot more with the dams than you have. I imagine you're limited to some extent by your budget, right? And so really we're sort of limited in what we can do. And I guess that would be my concluding statement is with some more resources, we could probably do a lot to better understand and better mitigate these hazards.
Eric, closing statement.
Thanks, Ray. I would agree that better understanding of our context and the exposure that we have allows us to manage that in a better way. I think I appreciate the way that we're able to move forward and advance our understanding and make change where we need to, locally, regionally, nationally. I think having stakeholder understanding and partner understanding of how we can make things better and where we need to is also really important. That's why I appreciate you here today listening and understanding what I'm saying. Thank you.
Before we thank our guests today, I want to also acknowledge the sponsors such as Jerry Dilhelm. Jared Dilhelm is a Eugene architect, landscape architect, and planning and urban design consultant. Thank you, Jerry, for your ongoing support. And the Academic Extension of University of Oregon. The Academic Extension brings the university's fine teaching and research to our regional community, of course, to the Oregon Country Fair, and to our host, the Baker City. Now, folks, there's somebody who's coming off our board and who's also served as a past president and continues to give us many, many hours. And he's actually going to be moving away from the area. But I wanted to take a moment to thank you, James Baldock, for your service and on the board as president and on the program committee for all the many, many hours you're giving us. Certainly you bring balance to the board, and I want to thank you personally and on behalf of City Club. He will continue to be involved in the fundraising committee and the program committee until he has to say adios. Now, as you know, there is no program next week on May the 26th, so please join us here at the Baker Center on June the 2nd for predictive scheduling. Is it right for Oregon? Additional information can be found at www.cityclubofeugene.org. Now, let us give a big round of applause to today's speakers, Eric Peterson and Ray Weldon, for your service. My name is Juan Carlos Valle, and this concludes today's program. Thank you so much.